it's on another plane, on another level. I think I answered that question before about what happens with those souls that have no need for another incarnation. But getting back to your first question, just what determines the shape and form of the incarnated soul is the prior lifetime cassette, as I'd like to call it, of the actions of this individual in a prior lifetime. That will govern and direct the, again, a replay. Everything happens again, all over again, giving the individual or that soul another opportunity to correct that which he didn't in a prior lifetime.
Well, as I'm understanding, his question is who makes the determination when he's going to reincarnate? Is that pretty much an individual responsibility?
This is going to sound very strange, but we're touching on another subject. Why do some souls wind up with one set of parents, and some souls wind up in a mansion with luxury, and the other one in a deprived neighborhood and with no chance of advancement? Who determined that? The Lord? That would be an unfair situation. It certainly smells of inequality. And consequently, getting into who determines that, without getting into the details, it's the parents who provide at the time of intercourse and conception determine which soul is going to reside with them. In other words, if two people who might even hate each other, but you know, sex is a very strange phenomenon, and while they couldn't stand each other's guts, nevertheless, they can still decide on having sex that evening. But the fact that their energy intelligence is of a nature and quality of extreme negativity, they then, and as a result of that, of the intercourse, a conception ensued, the conception prepares a vessel that is capable of handling this extreme negativity, and consequently you have a child who is negative. But that child is negative because there is a soul that needs that kind of, that particular vessel of negativity to fulfill is what we call the tikkun process, the correction process. So you see that so much is not within the realm of the Lord. So much is really free choice, but maybe you've got to know the rules and regulations. But it all winds up to our own doing.
Okay, well, that's not so far off from what I think.
Want to make it quick, Alan? We got a bunch.
Okay, one last one. What's the technology of the Kabbalah? How do you achieve this loss of self-grasping that you seem to talk about, or selfishness, and actually improve yourself?
I think the first step is recognizing our own limitations and recognizing that two opinions are both correct at all times. And once we recognize that everyone else's opinion is as correct as mine is, because in Ecclesiastes we're told that, chapter 7, that God created one against the other. In other words, and Heisenberg, I guess, with his uncertainty principle, established that principle, that everything is real and everything is unreal. Who is right and who is wrong? If the way you see things as reality is reality, and if someone sees it in just in an opposite perspective, that's reality too. So we're all right and we're all wrong. And once we begin to recognize the finite of ourselves, I think we're really heading towards a road of understanding our fellow neighbor.
Okay, Alan, does that help you?
Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
For the questions. And thank you for the answers there. They were fine. I'm Bill Jenkins. Tonight we're talking about the Kabbalah. And with me is Rabbi Philip Berg. Have on the line, hello. It's
Hello?
Yes?
Hi, this is...
Rabbi Kravitz?
Yes, it is.
How are you, Rabbi?
Good evening. How are you?
It's good to have you aboard.
Thank you very much. I wanted to touch, ask a question, a clarification on the last explanation that Rabbi Berg gave about who determines how a person's reincarnated.
Mm-hmm.
It was my understanding, and specifically in reading a book, a Kabbalistic book, a Hasidic philosophy book called Tanya, that it's really God that determines where a person is reincarnated, and the concept of the relationship of the parents, the physical relationship determining some having some effect on the soul, has to do with the spiritual garments that the person is invested in of thought, speech, and action. Machshava, Diba, and Maisa, and not that they determine which soul is born into which body. So that seemed pretty different than what I had been learning in the Kabbalah.
Thank you for your question, Rabbi. As we know that there are 70 different faces to the understanding of the Torah, the Bible, I have simply quoted, without quoting my source reference, but the Rabbi Isaac Luria in his Gates of Reincarnation, I believe it's chapter 27, Perek Kav Zayin. I think it's page 92. I'm not familiar, but I'd be more than happy to refer the source reference, the direct source reference. That which I mentioned previously to one of the callers is exactly as stated by Rabbi Isaac Luria. There are different understandings. There was two giants in Talmudic literature. Tanaim, one said permitted, and the other one said it was not permitted. And from a Kabbalistic point of view, we know they're both correct. If you understand the phrase, they're both correct. And if we, on our terrestrial level, if we can understand that all of us, with our strict opinions and thoroughly knowledgeable, all of us are thoroughly knowledgeable, nevertheless, the other person's opinion is also correct, as diametrically opposed as it might be. Consequently, there are different viewpoints, and they're all correct. However, we understand that they're all correct. But what I did quote you was straight from Rabbi Zaburi's Gates of Reincarnation.
It just seems a tremendous limitation on God to say that he is not involved in the determination of whether a person, as you said, is born into a family of wealthy people or a family of very poor people. I mean, it seems that everything comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, from God, and it would seem a tremendous limitation. You kind of hesitated when you said that, and it seems that all Kabbalistic literature and Hasidic literature really puts, you know, everything in God's hand except Kol Bidei Shemayim Chutz LeYerushalayim. Everything is God's hand except the fear of God. And it just seems so different than...
It's not different at all. The statement you just quoted in Hebrew is something I am completely in accord with. Then we'd probably be spending, the next couple of Saturday night sessions on Bechira v'Yediyah. In other words, if God knows all, then where is our free will and choice, and is it all determined? So the fellow says who murders, look, God knew in advance I was going to murder. You know, we'd have to get into that kind of a discussion. From a Kabbalistic point of view, I'm happy to say, and in my forthcoming book on reincarnation, I'm going to present the idea of the way I received it from my teacher, and that it is not contradictory. God knows it all, but then again, if he knows it all, then is he involved? Well, he's involved. Yes, of course he's involved. He is the, what we say in Hebrew, the mapik. He's the producer of the show. He is the one who is going to place that soul. I mean, who's going to place the soul with those particular parents who are building the kind of body that will be the proper receptacle for the soul. I mean, that the parent does not do. I mean, that soul enters by means of the producer being the Lord. So he's involved very much so. But in determination, which was the question, that is left to man. We do have a certain, we do exert a certain amount of free will.
You're holding that way.
Yeah. No, that's not my opinion. I'm merely quoting. In fact, all my books, I'm happy to say, is none of my material. It's everything that I've learned, and I quote in all my books the source references. So it's not my opinion. I may have misinterpreted what was written, and I would have to agree with you. But nevertheless, this is the way I read Rabbi Isaac Lurie's interpretation of determinism in the rebirth, reincarnation of the soul.
Okay.
Well,
thank you very much for clarifying
you.
That.
Well, thank you for joining us here, Rabbi.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have, is that Pier Luigi? I'm trying to get you in. Here we are. You with us now, Pier Luigi?
Yes. The
button didn't want to stick, but
okay.
Now we've got you.
First of all, let me congratulate you for your show. I think it's wonderful. I've been waiting for almost 2 hours to talk to you, and I think it's been worth every single second. I do have a few questions. I've been hearing a lot about your program, but nobody has touched yet the subject of Atlantis or the subject of... I heard at the beginning of the show you were talking about astronauts about 2,000 years ago. It seems that the most important questions in the show is about reincarnation. So let's start with the question, excuse me, with a question about reincarnation. Let me put it this way. The population of the world is growing every day. 2,000 years ago, there wasn't as much population as there is today. And, of course, it seems that nowadays we have more bodies here than there were souls to start with. So how do you explain that?
And they're all on the San Diego freeway.
Excuse me?
Just throwing in a little levity here, Luigi. The question being, we have so many more living human beings now than we had, say, 5,000 years ago.
That's right. In other words, it seems that there are more bodies now than there were souls to start with.
Where does the spiritual intelligences that were the souls come from?
That's right.
Okay.
Just how many souls are there?
Well, that's what I expect you to...
Well, from a Kabbalistic point of view, one soul can be divided into an infinite number of levels of consciousness, and they'll all be classified as an individual soul, although they may be part of one whole soul. But getting to your question of there appears to be so many more people around, Rabbi Isaac Lurie in his Gates of Reincarnation touches on that subject. And says, since we have entered the age of Aquarius, and we're going to have to speed up the process. There isn't that much time left. In fact, from a Talmudical point of view, and both from a Kabbalistic point of view, the approaching of 6,000 years, and that leaves us just with about 255 years. And all those souls who have to come back are going to have to come back in a very limited number of years.
And what's going to happen in 255 years from now?
Either that ball of fire comes down, if we can't do the job, or we're all going to do it. But we're living in the Age of Enlightenment, and that's certainly a plus on our side.
In the age of what? I come from a different country, so there are some words in English that I still don't understand. I'm sorry.
No, what I'm saying is that the process has to be speeded up, and consequently, so many souls that are in the wings on the stage of history waiting to return for a correction purpose requires a larger number of corporeal bodies to handle these infinite amount of souls. And since there is a limited time left by which they can make their appearance, we therefore experience so many more people coming into existence, more than ever before.
That doesn't mean that the souls weren't always out there, Pierre Luigi, waiting for an opportunity to get into physical life. They may have had to wait a long time because there just weren't that many little opportunities, but they're growing for them now.
In this case, where did these souls come from? How did they originate? Was it a creation of God? Where are they waiting now?
Well, that question was asked before. Where there is a place, a metaphysical area, remember, when we speak of souls, we're speaking of energy intelligences, not in the in that same frame of reference as a part of body.
I'm well aware of that.
And so they're around. They're right next to us. The fact that we don't see them, the fact there is an expression in the Zohar that if we all suddenly achieved a total awareness of what was around us, we would die of fright. It would just be too much to handle at one time. So there's enough space there for energy intelligences, and they don't, you know, the atom doesn't occupy too much space. And if you're going into the subatomic area, it even occupies less space.
I'm always fascinated by the astral travelers who do move over into that realm for a while and have some amazing things to tell you about what's happening on the other side. And it's frightening to them sometimes. And sometimes not.
Okay, well, I'm still not have my mind completely clear about the question, about the answer you're giving me about the question, but let's move into a different topic. At the beginning of the show, I heard you were talking about astronauts about 2,000 years ago. Can you tell me a little bit more about it? Actually, I didn't hear the whole conversation. I was distracted for a minute. By the time I got back to the phone, I heard you were talking about astronauts. Can you tell me more about it, please?
Well, something very close to home, and I know which might come to as a shock to most of your listeners, Bill, but the Hebrew New Year seems to have found its niche in a certain religious expression, New Year, and even doing repentance and so on. But there was another aspect of Rosh Hashanah called the Shofar.
You want to hold on to that aspect because we have another one that came up here. It's called the news at 11 o'clock.
Okay.
And Pierre Luigi, would you want to stay with us?
Yes.
We'll take a break and pause for news and then back with hour three of Dr. Philip Berg, the author of The Kabbalah Connection. And we're connecting you with it tonight. You're invited to stay with us this next hour and join on in. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind.
Happy celebration 25.
It's hour three of Open Mind tonight. Come on in. We've had a stimulating conversation, one that makes you kind of think a little bit. And it all got started when I picked up a book called The Kabbalah Connection by Dr. Philip S. Berg. And I was saying, this guy's been listening to the Open Mind show because so much of what is in there is some of the things that we have learned along the way these last 6 years, you and I, as we have these seminars we call Open Mind. And I'm so very delighted to have Dr. Berg in studio with us. We're talking about the Kabbalah. We were talking to Pierre Luigi. And you're back on.
Okay.
I know we're getting back to kind of space travel.
Indeed.
The shofar, that's the ram's horn, which is used on Rosh Hashanah, that is for the Jewish New Year, from a Kabbalistic point of view, is the origination or the origin of what we today refer to as Star Wars. While at the present time we're still involved with physical technology in creating a physical device for the benefit of a particular country. But the real Star Wars, takes place on this level, right where we are. And it all is linked up and bound up with man's own activity. And the shofar is an instrument that encompasses the entire space program, possibly from an abstruse angle, but nevertheless, the Zohar in Leviticus, the beginning of Leviticus, has a treatise on the aspect of energy travel from this universe into outer space, without getting into details. So the Rosh Hashanah, as a classic example from a Kabbalistic point of view, encapsulates all of the knowledge that is involved in the Star Wars program, but on a much much more sensitive and I might say more powerful level than we can even dream of. The Bible also makes reference to the gravesite of Moses, that there was no gravesite, and from the point of view of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Moses did not die, and neither did Elijah the prophet. And the description, the biblical description of his ascending towards the heavens, clearly demonstrates the use of spacecraft. In his elevation to the terrestrial level, extraterrestrial level.
Okay, and your study of how he ascended to the sky, what kind of vehicle did he use? Was it a rocket? Was it something that was moving due to anti-gravitational forces? Or what can you tell me about it? Did you get to find out, or where did he go?
Well, kind of hard to answer that question.
What he's thinking?
I'm sorry, I come up with such hard questions.
No,
that's okay.
I'd have to use some kind of terminology and then get into the clarification of this terminology. But the Zohar makes use of a word called Metatron, Metatron angel. All angels are actually spacecrafts. In what we pray, our prayers have no ability to touch and experience time travel, meaning reverting back into time. And incidentally, the grandfather paradox, which kind of stymied Einstein, is explicable. There's no problem. He might have had a problem with it, but from a Kabbalistic point of view, there is no problem. We can return in time. And the way that is done is by making use of these angels, referred to angels, I guess, for the lack of a better word. But they're not angels with wings. Even that concept, like, where did that come from? Why does an angel have to have wings? Because it is a kind of spacecraft which, with proper meditation, Kabbalistic meditation, we can connect with these particular spacecraft vehicles called angels, and they in turn, from a Kabbalistic point of view, and if you like to refer to the Zohar, you might refer to Exodus in the portion of the week called Vayakhel, V-E-Y-A-K-H-E-L, and there's a kind of some information on how we can make use of these various spacecrafts for particular purposes. You can't use the same spacecraft for every destination.
Historically speaking, when did mankind first have an encounter with a spacecraft?
Adam.
Yeah. That's where it started.
Adam and Eve, are you talking about them?
That's correct.
You mean he came here in a spacecraft?
Well, we're getting there. We're now discussing physical spacecrafts. We don't understand yet that we can, according to Rabbi Isaac Lurie and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, we're on the threshold of human being flying without the necessity of mechanical devices.
I know some who do that quite often.
I believe in that.
Where are you flying to, huh?
I get accused of doing that from time to time, I think.
Okay, I have a couple more questions. I know that there are some other people waiting on the line. Coming back to the reincarnation subject, and let's view into space now. We have such a huge universe, which is actually limitless. It doesn't have an end. There are so many stars and solar systems and other planets where life would be possible. Do we have to reincarnate here on Earth, or can we reincarnate somewhere else within the universe?
We can reincarnate anywhere in the, shall I say, 254 universes. Don't ask me how I know it, but I'd have to ask my friend Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who lived some 2,000 years ago, and maybe he can give me an explanation how he arrived at 254, but that's what he says. But for the tikkun process, for an incarnation, to finally achieve the ultimate correction, there is only one place for that, and that's right here, on planet Earth.
All right, Luigi, did that help you?
Not exactly. I'm sorry, I got a little bit lost again.
Well, I'm going to have to go on because we've been with you a long time.
Okay,
and some of the other ones. And I appreciate your questions.
Okay, Bill, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's open mic.
I'm glad that the focus of the forum is getting into this extraterrestrial aspect, and the focus has shifted this way. I'd like to ask a question, but prefer to preface that question with a explanation of how I came to want to ask this question. In my youth, I had an encounter, so-called close encounter number three, at age 13 years. These were beings definitely more advanced than I, but there was a kinship felt, like they might know me from the past or would know me in the future. There was considerable psychic fallout ever after that. And approximately 10 years ago, I looked up in the Encyclopedia Judaica about Kabbalistic tradition. Prior to the time it was written in the oral history, there were several sects of Kabbalists who would pass this word and these words of power onto their own members on as an oral tradition only, certainly more than 3,800 years ago. One of the sects' names translated as "We Who Descend to the Chariots." And that name and the meaning of it has always been eluding all of the so-called experts in the Kabbalistic and the Judaic history. My question, Rabbi Berg, is could it be that it was mistranslated as "we who ascend to the chariots"? Because certainly I don't believe they were talking about chariots with wheels and so forth at that time.
When I was referring to the first document, written document on the mysteries of the Kabbalah and its explanation of terrestrial and extraterrestrial knowledge, I was referring to a written document some 3,800 years ago, authored by Abraham the prophet, called the Sefer Yetzirah, Book of Formation. However, in the Book of Splendor, the Sefer HaZohar, there is mention of a book that was presented to Adam, including all the information concerning technology, astrology, you name it, it was all there. And that's called the Sefer Toldot Adam. It's a book which we refer to as the book that Adam, and when Adam was driven out from the Garden of Eden, that book became lost. The people of the Tower of Babel were in possession of that book, and therefore this kind of wild technology that the Bible seems to infer was taken from that book. Now, all I can tell you about that book is that it's going to be revealed in whatever form that may have been already revealed, in which technology, as we have seen it in the past 50 years, will be nothing compared to what we're going to experience in a very short while. There's just going to be a tremendous leap into and enter a completely new era of advancement, and it will not be on the basis.